Kia ora, this program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Wellington Access Radio, make your voice heard.
The Quilted Bananas program plays every Sunday, 10 to 11am, with news, views and music.
A collective of presenters, advertisers, community events and discusses news of interest to lesbians, queer women and non-binary folk.
We have interviews about past and future sports and cultural events, politics, films, art shows.
The program is sponsored by the Arthur and Armstrong Charitable Trust for Lesbians.
And it plays every Sunday from 10 to 11am on Wellington Access Radio, 106.1 FM.
Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the Fam Rants Show. I'm Sian, and I'm just going to start with an introduction to myself. So, ko Glastonbury Tour, tōku mōnga, ko Ask, tōku awa, ko Avondale, tōku waka, ko Sian, tōku ingoa. It's great to be here with you on this Sunday. I've been a little bit unwell, so my wairua is a little bit scattered, but I'm here with two beautiful, grounded humans, so all will be well. So we have Kura with us, and we also have a very special guest with us. We have Hannah Wazwa with us. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Buju, Hannah Wazwa, an Indigenous Kaz, Amatung and Dunji, Wasa Gama King, Ninda Noki Iwen, Ogama Khan Iwen, Niwe Danoki Mag, Bejig, Ogama Khan, Gayetash. Niwen Ogemaka Nesag, Niwe Bungi Ewindamonan, Ne Bizendamin, Migwachga Gabizendameg. So, hello, my name is Hannah Wazwa. I'm from Amatung First Nation in North America, Canada, located in the heart of Treaty 9. I am a counselor for my First Nation, so I'm a member of the leadership, and I am one of the first queer people to be elected into our community's leadership.
Kia ora. Welcome. Warm welcome.
Thank you.
And Hannah has made the connection with the show through meeting Kura. So, kia ora, Kura.
Yeah, kia ora, Sian, Bozu, Hannah. It's really good to have you here. So, no mai, haere mai.
Ka pai. So, I thought that we could welcome Hannah in with a waiata. So we've got Wahine Toa by Mahina Rangi Toka.
I'm black inside, but I'm a rainbow when you look at me. I have no labels, but those you choose to see. There are no excuses, so I have no explanations. There are no excuses for ignorant condemnation.
My mother is strong.
My mother is strong.
My sisters are proud.
My sisters are proud.
We are so strong.
We are so strong. Strong and proud. Strong and proud. Strong and proud and loud. I'm black inside, but I'm a rainbow when you look at me.
Bye. I love that waiata. So, welcome, Hannah. And I thought we could begin by asking you about what you would like to start with in terms of maybe an origin story, or where do you come from, where do you feel that you begin?
Sure. So my family is a blended family. I think of it as blended between cultures. Mm. My father is Anishinaabe from Amatung First Nation, and my mother is a settler from Nova Scotia. And so they came together almost 27 years ago, and they met each other and they decided they'd make a life together. And over the course of their lives, they've had to make many compromises for each other. And one of them was in the way that my siblings and I were raised. So we were raised very much to be able to function in both societies, the success of which could be debated. But I feel very comfortable fluctuating between settler and Indigenous communities. For myself, I identify as both Anishinaabe and a settler. So in many respects, I have very many responsibilities at home right now as an Anishinaabe person, especially in terms of making decisions and helping my community to achieve its potential and for its people to thrive and flourish. And then on the other hand, I feel that I have settler responsibilities in Nova Scotia to make amends and to be a part of my family living life in a good way in Nova Scotia, in Mi'kmaq territory. Mm. So I like to conceptualize my place as a place of responsibility and as a place of coming to good relations with each other.
Mm. And what an important way of being in the world that we're in right now. It feels like things are so adversarial in mm-hmm. the world so often at the moment, and almost like I have an image of like kind of ape being sort of banging our chests and being, you know, who's the loudest or who mm-hmm. is the biggest, it's not really getting us to very good places, that way of interrelating with each other.
Yes.
We're not really able to have very good conversations that way.
Mm. Yeah. It's been funny because a lot of the conversations that I've had since being here are very much reinforcing to me that, yes, this is the way that I want to walk, and so I'm mm. very grateful. I've only been here since Tuesday, so I've been very grateful to all the conversations that I've had with both settlers and Maori people since I've been here.
Wow, so you've been in Aotearoa for maybe four or five days?
Yes, I'm not sure. Time change has really messed me up.
Yes, it's very, very strange, isn't it? Yeah, and So just going back to that idea of how we live in a good way, or how we have conversations with each other, it's probably the last couple of years where I started seeing a lot on social media and reading a lot about people saying the only way that we're going to save the world and work to prevent disastrous climate change is by listening to Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I heard that and I thought, yep, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But I don't exactly know what that means in a deeper way. And over the last couple of years, just been listening more for what that means. And one of my understandings is that it's about connection. Mm-hmm. I know you've got a lot of thoughts on this area.
So I am actually here, and on Tuesday I'll be doing a more in-depth conversation about it at Te Papa Mare. Mm-hmm. Mm. I don't know if that's how I'm actually supposed to say it, but I'm working on my pronunciations. So, in terms of connection, I think that when I talk to Indigenous people, there's very much a depth of spirit that I don't find settlers often have. And it's a very unconscious thing. It's not very much expressed, but it's mutually understood. And so it's hard to have these conversations with settlers because there isn't that mutual understanding or that mutual depth of spirit that allows you to connect with each other. And so we often just end up talking past each other. And I don't think it's a fault of settlers. I think it's... I hope I don't offend anybody by saying this, but I think it's a sense of disconnection from the land that you're surrounded by, and a deep longing for something more, but without having the words to express what that is, we end up missing the meaning of each other's sentences and each other's words, and we come to places where we are very much working past each other.
There's so much that's been lost, hasn't there? Through colonization and I think those ways of being connected, last weekend I was in Christchurch with my sister, and we went to visit a woman who is a herbalist. And we went into her her shed, her drying shed, and she wasn't there. She was hosting some other people. And we walked into the shed, and it was like an electric shock. And both of us fell silent. And I walked around with this electricity, going, "This is something my ancestors did, or something." I think of it like a shift in the sort of fabric of the universe or the air or something, where something's coming through, and my sister and I, we don't talk about that sort of spirit level. And just as I was leaving, I said to her, that was fun. That was funny in that room, eh? I thought, I'll just kind of try and like broach it a little bit. And she came to meet me with it, and she said, I could really feel, so I didn't want to talk, and I didn't want to, we ended up somehow being able to have this conversation. And I said to her, do you think maybe that's one of the things our ancestors did? And she said, yeah. And I said, I think that's the only way that we can know, that feeling shift. But yeah, Western culture has forgotten the rituals or forgotten the ways to get back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you feel like, I don't know, that like with words, I always feel like, they're so clunky, they're so rubbish in so many ways. But in terms of ritual or ways of connecting back to, do you feel like you have more more strength in those connections, maybe?
I think so. I think when I look at other settlers, I think I've been very blessed to have an Indigenous understanding of what it means to be in the world and what it means to connect with your environment on a level. And just to illustrate, maybe, when I came here, I was very nervous. I was very concerned. This is a land where my ancestors have never been. My ancestors are not here. It's a land that doesn't know me. Whereas back home, there are many places where the only way that I can explain how I feel in those places is that this land knows me and this land loves me, and I am home here. And so I was concerned coming here because I wouldn't have those places. But the first day here, I was shown very, very clearly that I would be welcome here as a guest and as a visitor. And that, you know, I will go home and I will bring back those lessons. But until then, I will be held here in safety. And I know that can sound very like esoteric or spiritual, but to me it's very real, and it's a deep part of my personal spiritual practice.
Beautiful, thank you. I think that part of the not being able to talk to settlers is about guilt. Massive rotten underlay of guilt, which blocks us from being able to connect.
And I think a part of the work that I do want to do in the world, like beyond caring for my community and making sure that we are able to move into the next phase of the world in as good a way as we can, is I do want to help settlers come to a place where that guilt isn't so debilitating. Because I don't think it's productive, and I think it's extremely limiting on the ways that we can be in relationship with each other if one side is constantly carrying this sense of guilt. And I know it's hard to discharge that guilt. It was very strange growing up as what other people would see as half white person, in a place where I always had an understanding of the violences that had been done to my community. Like, my grandfather and my grandmother and many of my aunts went to residential school, where they had their language taken from them, where they were beaten, where they had experienced sexual and physical and emotional and spiritual abuse, all while being apart from their families and separated from their siblings. And that's left a very deep scar on the psyche of my community and on many others as well. And growing up knowing that that had happened, and that also that my people had done that, my settler people, I had to come to a place of reconciling within myself, yes, this happened, and yes, it's good and expected to feel guilty for that, because it is a deep guilt that we should carry. But it also can't debilitate us from looking at it and recognizing the wrongs that have been done, and then carrying on and moving forward in relationship and restoring it. And I find that's the piece that most settlers can't understand, is that it's not a bad thing to feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
like when we talk about even grief, it's good to go through a grief process, and it's good to acknowledge that things that you have lost. And forcing those feelings away in favor of feeling good, or like pursuing happiness in really destructive ways, even. Like it's feeling bad only becomes a bad thing when you ignore it and you don't acknowledge what it's trying to teach you. That's kind of the whole philosophy of what I want to do here as well, is just like to recreate connection.
I feel like so often science is like catching up with the wisdom of indigenous cultures. So, you know, science, I read this thing about how in terms of emotions, you can't repress one emotion without affecting another. So, you know, you can't get rid of shame without affecting joy, or you can't, you know, that everything is interconnected. And one of the most striking things to me about Te Ao Māori when I first came here, which was about 20 years ago, was that it was like, wow, this is a culture which has this extremely massive amount of wisdom and knowledge about expressing emotions. So my first meeting with Te Ao Māori was that my partner at the time, his brother drowned in an accident, and his partner was Māori. They'd been together for a long time, and so we had a tangi, and so I had this experience of structured ways that people were brought into the room, and structured ways of behaviour where the body faced the one door, so people all came in one door and saw the body straight away, and as part of the family, seeing this happen over and over again, people come in, they cry straight away. There's no avoidance, there's no ability to pretend it's not happening or pretend it's not real. And that's, that's certainly a deep wisdom, I think, that, I often laugh with science. I'm like, oh, you just discovered intergenerational trauma. Oh, you just discovered, I think some other people knew about that a little while ago. Okay, should we have a piece of music, Kura?
Björk.
Awesome, thank you.
Offered me harmony. Black Nation. You didn't know I had it in me. We felt our love, an unspent capsule. I didn't know you had it in you. This eruption under stagnation. You didn't know I had it in me. This eruption under stagnation. You didn't know. You didn't know.
Awesome. So that was Björk from her album Biophilia, which is all about being in love with nature, in love with Papatūānuku and all the processes of her life. So I thought I'd just share a little bit from Te Kawa o Te Uruwera, which is the tūhoi document. What a ridiculous word for what this is. But it is their land management plan, we would call it in soulless English. But the page that I have bookmarked says, "Nature wills that there is no end to life." Tēnā koutou. Everything in nature suggests the infinite. Therefore, deep in nature lies our understanding of everything, an awe of how nature accomplishes everything. This marae te uruwera is not like any marae you may be accustomed with. This marae does not follow the conventions you may be used to. It has its own kawa. It serves to disrupt the norm. Te Kawa is about the management of people for the benefit of the land. It is not about land management. It raises hope for a renewed collective responsibility for our people impact on the land and foresees our disciplined response to those impacts. Together we invite an intergenerational outlook to introduce new practice for principled-based responsibility and management to meet our admiration and respect for Te Uruwera. Let us grow in ourselves a trust for one another and raise an age of better ethics and instincts. Te Kawa resets our understanding of our place in Te Uruwera. The Te Uruwera board is the voice and servant of Te Uruwera. The board knows well the value of its relationships in the futuristic work ahead and is optimistic of our success as people living with the land. That's Tamati Kruger, chairman. So I thought I'd bring that to share with you and with Hana, and we're just talking in the break about some of the resonances with some of your experiences turning things around.
Yeah. I was stunned to have, like, just see this right here, because it's very much very similar to a lot of things that have been going on in my community. About, I think, 5 years ago now, I graduated from university and I went back home to work for a while. And I worked with it was at the time a very new department. It's our resource stewardship department. And there were a lot of conversations in those early days about how we wanted to do this and what would be best, the best approach for us. And through those conversations, we came across something that an elder had said. I don't remember how long ago or in one context it had been recorded, but the quote was, the people belong to the land, and the land belongs to the creator. And it was a complete flip of the way that we'd been taught in English to understand ownership and belonging. Mm. And so it was really foundational to the start of that department, and it was also foundational to me in beginning to understand what it meant to be in relation to the land. Mm. Because if I am not because in English you can only say, like, this is my land, this is mine, mine, this belongs to me. And so it's really flipped for me on my that English phrasing and helped me understand, no, this land doesn't belong to me, but I am here and I need to take care of it because this land takes care of me.
Yeah, I think with all of the changes happening at the moment, there's a slow kind of understanding that I start to see happening about how kai food, it's not automatic. It's about the care that we take of the land, because the land, we're nothing without the care that it gives to us. And it's sad how it has to come to how much things cost. Like,
yes.
last winter there was a lot of rain, and certain sort of very ordinary vegetables became very expensive, like cauliflower. Cauliflower was suddenly
cabbages,
very expensive, and people are sort of, you know, of course, you know, furious, and then this conversation, well, it's very muddy, people can't get them out of the ground, and, you know, and there's a sort of like extremely slow sort of, oh, okay, it's not automatically always going to be the same price in the supermarket, because it didn't get born in the supermarket or something.
Yeah, I've always found, well, I'd never understood farming until I saw a farm come to my community. And then I have an ex-partner who's a farmer, and I did not understand their passion for this, especially because, well, my partner was a settler, so it didn't feel real to me. And then the first time I saw a farm on my community, I had this moment of realization of, oh, this is about feeding people. This is about being able to sustain ourselves and sustain the people we love. And that very much resonated with me and very much helped me understand what was happening. One of the funny things about North America is, if you look into the history, a lot of the settlers who first came over described this land of abundance and of like just incredible amounts of food and wildlife and green spaces that they had never seen before. But because of their lens, they weren't able to understand what was happening, is that indigenous people were very much in tune with the land. And if you look at cultures with a strong history of farming, like the Haudenosaunee, and their whole confederacy is very much, they have the three sisters, the corn, the beans, and the squash, and they would plant them together, in not in a monoculture, because all those plants together supported each other. And because they weren't a monoculture, and because they didn't look like farms that settlers understood, they assumed that this was wild in nature, and this is how nature just does it here. And that was very false. And this is something I learned recently, is that sweetgrass, sweetgrass is a medicine that's grown in Turtle Island in specific places, and it's one of the sacred medicines that for many people. But the fact is that if humans do not harvest sweetgrass, it will die. Because the humans are an essential part of the sweetgrass's life cycle. So it has grown in relationship with us, and if we abandon that medicine, it will abandon us. And sweetgrass doesn't grow in my area, so this is something that I wasn't aware of until very recently. And I think that's a part of what's missing from settler understandings, is that humans are a part of our environment. We are a part of this, and we have relationship with all of these plants and animals, and it's on us to continue to live in a good way so that those relationships continue.
Yeah, I really agree with that. And as you mentioned earlier, that in our languaging as well. It's about owning land or and controlling land as well, mm-hmm. and controlling those processes, which when you do some farming or you do some gardening, it just seems like quite a ludicrous idea quite quickly because she's got a lot of plans of her own and a lot of relationships of her own that are going on regardless of whether you're kind of there or not. It's quite lovely to hear that that story about the sweet grass. That's mm-hmm. That's a real treasure, because sometimes I wonder if it, if everything would be better off without us. For me, it's something about the ego, holding ourselves apart, lifting ourselves up above or away from nature, where it's that I think of it like a lying down into the earth. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm one of these animals. I'm one of these plants. The same. It's a lot to think about. I need moments to think. Let's have another song.
Tension in your jaw. Tension in your jaw. Tension in your jaw. Around your lips. Around your lips. Around your lips. Tilt your head, tilt your head. Suva, suva, kind of arrogance, kind of arrogance. Auckland, Brisbane. All of you. Who made the news? Who made the news? I can see Fiji in your eyes. And it's looking good. I can see Fiji in your
designer.
Eyes still, an intense beat.
Designer clothes.
In our veins, a visible glow.
A visible sheen.
On our skin, branded by the trade. Winds who came
on
of age.
Skin.
In those islands.
On your skin, on your skin. Greed in your bellies.
Greed in your bellies.
St. Joseph.
I can see Fiji in your eyes, and it's not looking good.
So that was Teresia Te Aua from her album I Can See Fiji, and she was a great Pacific leader and educator in our communities, and we lost her a couple of years ago. So yes, I'm playing her words quite regularly, lots of things about place and love and devotion to place. So, I want to not run out of time to talk about what you're here for, because I just feel like we could just, certainly mm-hmm. talk all day. So, what has brought you to these shores is this thing which is called Mindset of Design, which is a conference in Wellington. And there's all sorts of things about... about design thinking and all of the rest of that kind of business, and we'll put that link up on the Facebook. But your piece is called Indigenous Perspectives, Designing Our Future, Mino Bima Dizawin, Living Life in a Good Way, a Fireside Chat, and it's on Tuesday at 2 o'clock at Te Papa. So tell us a bit about what this session will be.
Okay. Yeah, so it's gone through a few different iterations. We had somebody else who was going to be coming with us, and at the last minute she wasn't able to join. So a lot of it is really now going to focus more on things that I know more about. And the basis of it was always going to be Mino Bima Dizawin. And that is a really foundational philosophy in Anishinaabe culture, because it's how do you live life in a good way? And you spend your whole life living your life just working towards finding your space and finding what it means for you to live life in a good way. And there's a lot of things about that are are more easily accessible, like rules about harvesting, like you never take more than a third of what's in the in an area because you want that plant to continue, or you want to live in a good relationship with that plant. And so if you take more than you need or more than that plant can give, both of those upset the balance between you, and that would be the opposite of Mino Bima Dizawin. And it's very personal. It's very much rooted in personal responsibility for your actions. And so that, in application to climate change and relationships and kinship, is what I'm going to be talking about on Tuesday. And it's going to be a fireside chat. So I'm going to be talking with a woman named Sandra Daniel, and the two of us are going to be in conversation with each other. And I hope that we're able to also facilitate a conversation with the people who are in attendance. I don't really believe in lecturing. I believe in conversation. So I'm hoping that's kind of what comes out of what happens on Tuesday.
Awesome. It says here, the mindset shift. One, understanding Indigenous ways of knowing and being. Two, exploring how cultures of disconnection have fractured our climate. And three, discerning the relational shifts necessary to rewrite our future. So when we were chatting before the show, you talked about relationship and kinship, I was just rolling around the sort of relationships between this work that you're doing, these understandings that you're sharing, and queerness and genderqueerness, and so I wondered if you had any reflections on those sort of relationships.
Yeah. Oh, big question. okay, well, there's a couple things in that. First of all, I am queer. I think it's added a great deal to my life. I would never change myself. I'm gay. In English, I am gay, and I am gender queer. I like to think of myself as gender neutral, as inhabiting that middle space between masculinity and femininity. It's hard to stay there. It's a hard balance to find, especially trying to find things that feel comfortable to me. Ojibwe is the English term for us, but in Anishinaabe culture, there are different understandings of gender that were, as a result of colonization and Christianity coming into our communities, that a lot of those understandings were lost, and now they are coming back. And I think I have found a word in a space that describes me, but I'm not comfortable moving into it yet, just because of how little I understand and how few teachings I've received in terms of actually knowing what my responsibilities would be in that role and what it would mean to inhabit it. Mm-hmm. I think relationally, I think relationships are about responsibility. Mm-hmm. If you're in relationship with everything, then you are inhabiting responsibility within all of those relationships. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't claim something that I don't understand the responsibilities mm-hmm. of. Mm. And so that's why I'm not sharing it at this point. But I'm hoping that in the future I will get there.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about this, the three of us, before we came in around, I asked you about pronouns, and mm-hmm. You said, pronoun indifferent.
Yes.
And so I wondered if, maybe you as well, Kura, had some reflections on that sort of, gendered pronoun thingy that we have in English language.
It's interesting because I think what I shared is that, the kupu for Māori ia refers to both pronouns, male, female. And I think, I suppose for me, when we're talking about identity, my identity is firstly about being whānau hapū iwi, and then being queer, but it's always the sort of whakapapa-based identity that's predominant for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in Anishinaabe Moan, which is the language, there are, like you say, no gendered pronouns. The pronouns are all, the third person pronouns are all non-gendered. Mm. And so our elders would have a hard time with that. They, in English, remembering that there's a difference between he and she. And so I would often, as a child, be referred to as he is over there. And other people would correct that on my behalf, but I never found it bothered me mm-hmm. in the way that it seemed to bother them. And only later did I understand, it doesn't bother me because I identify with both. Mm-hmm. And in English, I actually do prefer if people switch between mm-hmm. them for me, but that doesn't often happen.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing, though, about Anishinaabe Moan is that where the Romantic or European languages generally have gendered nouns. Our nouns are divided into two categories of either animate or inanimate. So is this alive or is this not alive? Mm-hmm. And there are some very surprising understandings in the language of what is alive and what is not. For instance, smoke is alive.
Mm.
Rocks are alive. Mm. And so if you understand what is alive and what is not, in that way, I find it adds a great deal of nuance into how you interact with the world. And just in my own personal experience, I do believe rocks are alive. Mm-hmm. We have sacred sites that are literally sacred rocks. And to someone who doesn't understand that a rock can be alive, that sounds absurd, especially to settlers, it's a rock. Why do you want to protect this space? Or why can't we build here? Why can't we demolish this rock for mm-hmm. our needs?
Mm-hmm.
But if you've been in relationship with that place over many generations,
mm-hmm.
then it is essential to our well-being to protect those places.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. My sister, she works for ECAN in Christchurch, and she took me in on the Sunday into her work, and they've just been gifted a huge piece of Painamu, which is a sacred stone mm-hmm. to Māori, and it's found in the South Island. So people who work at ECAN had gone with Ngāi Tahu and found this huge rock, and it's been brought into their work, and she said, here it is, and everyone's invited to touch it, and mm-hmm. I touch, and straight away you feel that Māori, that mm-hmm. life force in that stone.
Right. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I just wanted to ask you one last thing, which was about how you see leadership So you're a leader in your community?
Yes. It's actually, well, it's funny. Like, I grew up very much feeling disconnected from every culture around me, which is kind of the opposite of what my parents were going for, was just to feel connected to all of them. Mm-hmm. But I felt I grew up feeling very much like I didn't belong anywhere and that I couldn't belong anywhere. And it was hard to come back to my community, I'll be honest. There was a time when I thought I would never go back, and I spent about 10 years outside of the community healing and coming to a place of understanding myself, which I really needed, and I'm very glad that I did. And I was afraid of coming back. I promised myself I would never go back in the closet. I would never make myself something into something that other people could understand, so that I could be accepted, because I'd already not belonged my whole life. So what was one more thing? And I was stunned. I'll be honest. I was stunned when I came home. And what I said at the time is, like, everyone is gay. And realizing how many queer people were in my community and how many queer people had been hurt by my community. And I've heard a lot of stories since I'd been elected of, like, trans kids or queer people or, like, of gay men and the way that our community had rejected them. Mm. And to me, there was one other person, and we call ourselves Two-Spirit in North America. It's a broad general term to, like, of an Indigenous person who is queer, but it originally came from Anishinaabe culture, and so there's varying understandings of it. But there was another Two-Spirit person who was also running, and she ended up dropping out because she decided she needed to go to school, and that was an important decision and one that I respected. But what she said to me was, "One of us has to make it," and I ended up being the one who made it, and in a really powerful way, I was in a race for the person with the most votes, all right till the end, and I came in second. I had almost 200 votes over another counselor who had served before, and that outpouring of support and outpouring of belief in what I could do for the community was incredible, and it was the first time I felt like I belonged in a really important and powerful way. And I'd been home for 2 years at that point, and I hadn't ever pretended to be straight or hid my relationship. I was very open. I tried to tell my grandmother that I was queer by introducing her to my girlfriend at the airport, and she's a very deaf woman. So I was at one point literally screaming, "This is my girlfriend," at my grandmother in a very public airport setting.
Beautiful.
She understood at the time, but since then she's really shown her support for me in a lot of ways that my more immediate family wasn't able to, because of the way that Christianity has been a part of their lives. So I understand leadership as not just responsibility, but as a representative of my community, to always be somebody who showcases the best of my people. And I love my home. I think it's the most beautiful place in the world, and I don't ever want to leave it. It is hard. There's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of really difficult things, but I think so many people are going into treatment and getting help for their for the way that trauma has affected them, and I respect that deeply, because I am also going into treatment. I've been in therapy for about a year now, and it's a difficult process. It's very hard. So I think a lot of what I need, what I want to do is, the one thing I promised my community was that I would bring the language back, that I would create language revitalization spaces, and that I would make that my priority. So that's the first thing I'm going to do. But in a broader sense, what I need to do is to create systems and spaces that allow for people's work on themselves to inhabit the land and the spaces that we live in. So whether that looks like community beautification projects, like rearranging the way that colonialism has imposed itself on us, changing, like even like simple things like landscaping around houses, because, you know, we don't get a lot of money to build homes for our people. And so what often happens is people have homes that are built on gravel lots, and it's just gravel completely around them. And that's such an unhealthy way to live. And it just reinforces how little that we're cared about. And if you can, I think if we can change the way that our homes and our spaces look, and if we can give people ways to see, no, I am cared for. And even though like maybe like this house isn't the greatest because we don't have money to fix it, at least I know that I can go outside and see something beautiful, or I can work to change it. And like, obviously I can't do all these things myself. What I see in the future is a community of people who are able to show up for each other.
Right.
And it's my responsibility to create a system that allows for that.
Kia ora. That's beautiful. Yeah, lovely quote listening to you.
Thank you so much. And come and listen and be by the fireside with Hannah on Tuesday at 2:00 at Te Papa. It's free, and you've already heard how much wisdom and wonder Hannah has to share. So come along and be part of that kōrero.
And just listening to you, Hannah, like lots of things you say about going into spiritual places and not belonging, it's, you know, it resonates with me as Māori. It's about even just going into different marae and looking after yourself by saying kupu or words that you need to say to protect yourself. And I'm sure that there are lots of other people or listeners who will resonate with your kōrero. So thank you very much for, you know, coming and sharing with us. It's just been beautiful.
Right. Thank you. Miigwechka visindamek.
Kia ora.
Nā kohi kohi nā, nā uri o te motu.
The Quilt of Bananas program plays every Sunday, 10 to 11am, with news, views and music.
A collective of presenters, advertisers, community events and discusses news of interest to lesbians, queer women and non-binary folk.
We have interviews about past and future sports and cultural events, politics, films, art shows.
The program is sponsored by the Arthur and Armstrong Charitable Trust for Lesbians.
And it plays every Sunday from 10 to 11am on Wellington Access Radio, 106.1 FM.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Thanks, New Zealand On Air, for funding the Access Internet Radio Project.